Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. We have the author of Little Heathens with us. This book was much discussed when we were talking with the New York Times book editor about the best books of 2007, and he just raved about the book, and we thought it would be something that's perfect for our conversations here from 9 to 11, so we're very happy to have the author of Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. Mildred Armstrong Kalish is our guest. And the book, she says, is the story of a time and a place in a family. That time was the Depression years, the place a rural area of Iowa, the family hers. They had to endure deprivation without complaining, learn to mind your manners at all times, do as your elders say. This is what the elders in our family expected of us and what the discipline and training they imposed were designed to elicit. In a very real way, Mildred says, the value system that shaped my early days has also shaped my life. Austere and challenging as it was, it built character. It fed the intellect and stirred the imagination. Mildred Armstrong Kalish, retired professor of English who grew up in Garrison, Iowa, and has taught at the University of Iowa, Adelphi University, and Suffolk Community College, and now lives in Northern California, is our guest. I hope some of you have had a chance to read this book, which is really a wonderful read. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Mildred.
Hi. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to it.
Yeah. Isn't it something how your book has just stirred so many people? You got a book, and I believe it was your first big book, that became one of the best books of 2007.
I think it's just fabulous. It has taken off way, way beyond my wildest expectations, and I'm absolutely delighted. So just a few days ago, we discovered that there are over 640 libraries across the United States that have chosen this book for their shelves.
Oh.
And I'm just thrilled with that.
I'm sure you are. And well, let's start with reading in libraries, as a matter of fact. That's one of the chapters in the book, the literary influences, that reading was a big part. You had not a lot of money and a hard life with a lot of chores, but the adults thought of reading as part of a cure for being a child, right? You were encouraged to read.
In effect, that's true. In some way, we were handicapped, and in some way, it was a blessing because we were not allowed to buy new books because they cost money, but Grandpa had a huge variety of books in his library, and of course then we had that wonderful Dr. Carl, who had a great library and loaned the books to my brothers, who would bring them home after they had delivered the Collier's and the Woman's Home Companion and the Saturday Evening Post. They would bring home these bags full of books from Dr. Carl's place, which kept us occupied. But I think the most unique thing about our situation out there was that, without realizing it, our grandparents and mother used reading as a reward.
Yes.
We were not allowed to read until we had done all our dreadful chores, and then we were permitted to read. And I think that's one of the cleverest things they ever did.
Yeah. And also you write that what they gave you to read was to supply examples of how you were to behave.
Yes. Oh, everything, just about everything, was didactic in that we had to learn a lesson. And we were not permitted, incidentally, to read what we would call trash, what is called trash now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's amazing to me how you remember. I mean, you're obviously a very smart woman, but you remember a lot of what you read in those times. You remember verse, you remember poetry, remember passages from books you read.
Reading for me was an escape, and I remembered things like, for instance, that Shepherd of the Hills incident where the main character, the shepherd, is doing his monologue in the dead of night, you know, pacing back and forth. That's a very vivid picture, saying, Howard, Howard, to think that I should be glad that you are dead. Wow, that it really is. And then to say, she died when Pete was born. I knew, you know, I was just intrigued by that entire scene. And I guess I just have a very vivid a kind of memory.
Well, that's why you have this book that's become so big. You have a wonderful memory. What a tough situation for your grandparents. Describe how your father just kind of disappeared when you were 5 years old. You still don't know when he died or why he left, right?
Absolutely not, except the implications are I'm not certain, but I think that he probably did some jail time because it was some, and probably for bootlegging, because I had other girlfriends after I grew up into my teens whose fathers had had the same thing happen to them. And incidentally, I think that situation of what happened to those males during the Depression years is... I am not sure it's ever been explored, and I think it ought to be, but I don't know how one would go about it. I have friends here at the Forum in California, this is a retirement community, who tell me their fathers disappeared, and they sidle up to me and say, you know, I was raised in my maternal grandparents' house, too. So it was not entirely a unique situation. But how do you go about... now, studying what happened to those men, you go up and say, you were a deadbeat dad? Tell us about it.
Right, right. So here your grandparents are taking care of you. You have your mom. So there are five people, and they're elderly. And you got the depression going on, and they must have, as you say, been scared to death of that, at this whole new responsibility that they had to take over. But they did it. They did it honorably.
Oh, yes. That's a situation that I don't entirely understand, to tell you the truth. Grandpa and Grandma had just retired from farming. They had, and there are so many things that are hard to understand during that period. They had managed to get together four smallish farms, that is, not big farms, 140, 240 acres. But they had four farms. They had managed to do that. Then they retired into Garrison. And and then everybody began losing their farms. And this, of course, was not entirely these people's fault. And this is why I think the father situation would be nice to explore if anyone had the time and the gumption to get about doing it. The Depression... There was no money, and not only was there no money, there were no jobs. And I think that it's just a very frightening situation. I felt the fright as a very little child. I knew there was something wrong. It was a time when they needed government intervention, and it was a time when government intervention would get in the way of the strong American philosophy as pull up your socks. You can make it on your own. We don't interfere with private enterprise. And that was a terrible situation.
Yeah. I loved your piece in the New York Times when you talked about you would have your own caucuses in Iowa, and we've just come back from Iowa from the caucuses. Yeah, we did broadcast in Dubuque and had one heck of a good time, Mildred.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But you were having those caucuses on the front porch. Your grandfather was.
That's right.
Yeah.
I remember sitting around listening to these people. These people are still very real to me. I can even see how they're dressed.
They are to me, too, after reading the book. They're real.
That's great. I love that. Grandpa was a very quiet man, but he had... real heroes, and he had real beliefs. He loved Abraham Lincoln. He loved Joe Louis, of all things. For my mild-mannered grandpa to love a boxer is absolutely amazing. And, of course, he loved Benjamin Franklin and and you know, good solid people.
Yeah, right.
And Roosevelt, of course.
And Roosevelt. There's some wonderful scenes, though. Your grandparents were pretty rigid about things. You go to your farm and live in with your mom, who has a whole different lifestyle. I love the chapters where you eat when you feel like eating, and she doesn't feel like cooking, so you might have just bread for lunch and,
right.
you know, have a cake, et cetera. But relishing all the things outside, all this time outside, and the blue skies and all of the animals, and, I mean, you really had a delightful childhood in some ways, hard as it was, right?
Absolutely. I think, and I don't know, this is possibly a congenital thing, I absolutely adored animals. Also, I adored being outside.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget the time when I first discovered that crabapple tree in bloom. And I'll never forget that. It was just such an incredible sight. I had gotten up early, which I frequently did. I'm still an early riser. And I had walked down the lane because nobody else was up, and it had rained during the night, and here is this tree in full bloom. And I will never forget that. And I loved being outside and loved all animals. And it was, in many ways, for me, it was idyllic.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways.
And then all of those, and we don't realize, because we're in such a culture of waste right now, and just beginning to learn what you knew growing up, the number of things that you recycled, you know, using every part of an egg, using again and again parts of clothing that were to be recycled, you really knew how to recycle, didn't you?
It was... Part of that was a necessity, and part was simply because Grandpa and Grandma, it's important to understand Grandpa and Grandma. They were of pioneer stock,
mm-hmm.
and their influences were late 19th century influences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very important thing to remember. You just didn't have things. I mean, you could not get to town, and if you got to town, there wasn't a whole lot of things to buy, and you went for necessities. And I think that is a very important thing. The other thing was that they loved land. The money was meant to buy land, and they did that. But the business of being thrifty has stayed with me all my life, much to the dismay of my kids, who get a little embarrassed by drying out the inside of a Ziploc bag so I can reuse it. But, Mom, it was supposed to be thrown. We were supposed to throw that away.
You know, and I think that those of us who didn't live through that, my parents were certainly the same way, that... You know, my mom darned her nylons again and again and again, and the socks again and again and again. And
right.
And unfortunately, they're both gone now, and I've been in the process of cleaning the house. And it's amazing to me how they just held on to everything. They just didn't have very much, even though they were doing better than their parents did during the Depression. But that mentality holds on, doesn't it? And it's hard for us to understand that because times seem to be better now, and we live in this society where you throw things away. But
yeah.
But you still have that. Tell me more about that. Why that stayed with you your whole life?
I think that the things you learn in your childhood are very hard to. I mean, they're pretty much there for good,
yeah.
Unless it's an onerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
But. I, for instance, can't throw away a sheet of paper that has typing on it only half. I put this paper aside, and when I get a nice little packet, I take it to the kitchen and cut the blank side off and very deeply stack them and put them under the telephone so that I can have paper to make notes on.
Oh, Mildred. Yeah.
I still do that, and it hurts me to... throw almost anything away,
mm-hmm.
and it's rather ingrained in me by now. But I don't see anything wrong with that.
No,
I think we're getting back to a point where we know that we've got to stop being such a wasteful society.
Yes, I think you are right. Mildred Armstrong Kalish is our guest, and the book, which has been receiving just very, very wonderful reviews and considered by the New York Times to be one of the best books of 2007, Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. Our phone number, our lines are busy, but eventually you'll be able to get through. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mildred Armstrong Kalish. We're chewing the fat with her. One of the expressions that she remembers from her childhood. Another great chapter in the book is about phrases that were used, and we'll get to that during this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have a full bank of phone lines, Mildred, so we'll start our calls with Diane from La Crosse. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just loved Little Heathens. I just finished reading it, and I have to thank Mrs. Kalish for explaining my in-laws to me. I've been married for 31 years. And kind of took it personally that my in-laws never hugged or kissed me. I come from a family of huggers and squeezers. And after reading the chapter about the hearty handshake method,
the hearty handshake, right?
I totally understand them. So thank you very much, and I loved your book.
I want to thank her for writing in on that. Because I have, that is one of the items that I get a lot of feedback on, and it was a very strange, and one of the reasons I loved my husband's family when I got married almost 64 years ago.
Oh my!
I just love them because they just hug and kiss you just because you're standing there.
Yeah. And tell the, it's a poignant chapter where when your great-grandfather comes to visit and how you prepare for his visit and how you are asked to be on his lap, and it's such a big thing. And you are a child, which seems fairly natural to come and sit on your great-grandfather's lap, but
not
it isn't natural. Not in your family, no.
That incidentally happens to be the very first thing I wrote. And I wrote that about 20 years ago.
Oh, my.
Grandpa, that event is just like a cameo in my mind. And it made such an impression on me, and I make a big point at the very end of that chapter pointing out that no one in my family ever mentioned the fact that he pulled me onto his lap, and I had the pleasure. At first, I was a little bit afraid, it just wasn't done. And I loved, I tell my friends these stories, and they'd say, Millie, you know, you ought to write those stories down. And so that's what I did.
And he had lost, talk about guns, he had lost most of his right hand, right?
Yes. That was, again, that was one of those. It was not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
He lost his hand. I mean, that was life. You took those things. He lost that hand in a gun accident, and everybody, even women, even very small kids, were given guns. When you were about 8, you got a BB gun. And that Shepherd play that runs every Christmas talks about you'll shoot your eye out. We heard that same expression. But then you were given a gun, and we all learned to shoot .22 rifles, and we were taught to shoot a .410 shotgun.
Wow.
Now, the 12-gauge was too heavy for any female, but just about every family had those guns. And it was just part of your life. It still is a part of a great number of Iowans' life.
Why did you have them? Why were you taught to shoot?
Because it was a way that you shot rabbits, you shot squirrels. It was a way to put meat on the table. That was one thing. And then I do have to tell you that, particularly for my younger brother John, he loved to hunt. They just love this kind of primitive thing of hunting. And I do have to tell you that we did love having a rabbit from the ubiquitous pork, chicken, and beef.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Diane, so much for your call. Let's go next to Dick from joining us from Iowa. I love it. Colesburg, Iowa. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
Hi.
I read the book.
Great.
I was very interested in it. I'm always interested in those books, especially about Iowans.
Great.
Rural Iowans. I grew up in the 30s. I was born in 1930. In 1933, we had to leave the family farm because they couldn't pay the taxes and the mortgage.
Precisely what I say in my book.
And then my uncle had to move off his farm in the 1930s. The land was all gone.
Yes. Wow.
But, you know, we lived through all those times. And I always thought that the Depression was in the 1920s until I got a little older and found out that I lived through the Depression. And we moved on to rented farms.
Yes.
And Dad was a forward-looking thing. He was a graduate of Iowa State College.
At Ames.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he was interested in things, and I think he was one of the first ones to plant soybeans in the state of Iowa. Somebody from the college
brought
him a bushel of those down there.
Yes.
Yeah, and forward-looking, he bought a tractor in 1937.
What kind of a tractor?
A John Deere B.
John Deere.
Yes.
A Pop and John.
Yes. Oh, and
everybody laughs when you say John Deere.
The kids on the bus used to make a lot of fun for the Poppin' Johnny.
Right.
Thanks so much for the call, Dick. Tell me about, because we hear so much about education, but you were afforded a great opportunity to be able to become a professor, to be able to become educated. Part of this, though, was you worked for other families, didn't you, when you were in high school? You were you were a governess. You were cleaning houses for people. Tell me about how you moved from Garrison, Iowa to becoming a professor.
Boy, is that a long story. The very first work I did was in Grace Baum's house. I cleaned a house for the lady in our small town who ran a dry goods department store at the top, over the top of the farmer's store in Garrison.
Mm.
From there, the next thing I did is I went to I was a companion for a retired Methodist minister's wife. And that was, I was just only then about 12 years old.
My.
Then I worked on the farm about 6 miles out of Garrison with this family of six children. I still keep in touch with a number of them.
Oh.
And then from there, I went to another farm, and anyway, went to teacher's college, went to New York, Yonkers, New York, with a governess for band leader's children. From there, I joined the United States Coast Guard Women's Reserve. From there, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, where I was a radio operator in the 5th Naval District, headquarters of the 5th Naval District in Norfolk, Virginia. From there, there I met my husband. As I said, we're going to celebrate our 64th wedding anniversary in next month, a couple of months from now. And from there, when we got out of the service, we headed straight for the University of Iowa and used that wonderful government-sponsored, brilliant idea of the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I went, from Iowa to Minnesota to Missouri, taught at the University of Missouri at Columbia, from there to Adelphi, I think it was at Adelphi that... where I became a professor. Then spent some wonderful years at Suffolk County Community College, which, if I may say so, was probably the best community college in the United States. It was a it is a marvelous institution.
Mm.
It does what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And that's the story.
That's a story. It's quite a story, Mildred. It's quite a story. Thanks very much for the call. Eugene from Viola is next. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I was born at the end of the Depression. And in 1946, my mother and father, we moved into an old farmhouse here in southern Wisconsin. He worked for a construction company driving a gravel truck. And when we moved there, we had a 32-volt light plant for electricity, a Monarch range for a cook stove.
Oh, great!
We had to carry all our water in. I wound up carrying the wash water Sunday afternoons when the wind wouldn't blow. You had to pump it by hand.
Absolutely. I described that in the book.
And it was an old forest pump up to an old log barn that... guy that we ran was second farm in the second house. It was a house on the second farm. And then during the winter months, during the summer, my mother put up about 600-700 quarts of canned goods.
Right.
We had a small country store down the road about a mile and a half, 2 miles. And my mother ran a charge account there during the winter. She paid it off during the summer. And then sometimes my father would come home. He'd give his always give my mother his check, and she would look at it and said, "Well, we got rained out for 2 days. 2 days I didn't work, and this is all I've got, pretty much." But I also, like you, I got my first BB gun when I was about 9 years old.
Right.
By the time I was about 12 or 13, I learned how to shoot a .22.
Mm.
Exactly. Tell me, did you ever ride a horse to that store about a mile and a quarter a day to pick up a few things?
No, I rode a bicycle, but one time my dad chewed Copenhagen, and one time he sent me down to the store to get him a box of Copenhagen.
Thanks, Eugene. Thanks so much for your call. Let's talk about some of these phrases, because actually I remember them growing up, too, from my mother who lived through the Depression. These two mottos that you had penciled in, 2-inch-high block letters on your dirty blue hardcover loose-leaf notebook that you carried with you from year to year, it's easier to keep up than to catch up. And this one, which I've heard frequently, I had no shoes and complained until I met a man who had no feet.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I think the reason I put that in, I wanted to make a point. One, that, you know, kids have a notebook and then they throw it away at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I kept that dirty blue notebook for 4 solid years, and I loved mottos like that. I was a sucker for that kind of thing. And I just recently heard a lovely kind of takeoff on that on the saying. These uplifting comments that make you feel all fuzzy inside, and that is, never judge a man until you have walked a mile in his shoes.
Yeah.
Then you stop and then you say, that way you're a mile away and you have his shoes. I love those.
Yeah, I do too. What about these phrases where you thought that it was one word, a good woman being that you know, hard-earned money, a good hard worker. You didn't think that they were separated.
No, and a good wool skirt.
And a good wool skirt.
Good wool skirt, yes. It says that you never heard them spoken you never heard them spoken as three words. You heard them always as one word until it just became that's what it was. I would love to have contributions from listeners if they have any more of those.
Yes, those would be great to hear.
I love those, and I also like to hear from people. I get a lot of emails, incidentally, and I like to hear from people whose mother and father have used the phrases that my grandmother used.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh, my grandmother used that expression, too. For instance, Bill Meade, who is an ex-Iowan, wrote a wonderful review of Little Heathens, and he said in this wonderful review, he said, my grandmother didn't call us little heathens. My grandmother called us miserable little heathens.
Oh, my gosh.
I have so many people come and say, my grandmother called us little heathens, too.
How would people email you, Mildred?
Oh, email me at millie@kalish.com.
Millie@kalish.com. And we would do Millie, M-I-L-L-I-E?
Right.
Okay.
And you could get to my website by www.little-heathens.com.
Okay.
And that's all small letters.
Okay.
And that you get my website. The website is fun. My daughter-in-law has done a wonderful job of keeping that website up for me.
Great. Let's go to Leslie from Chester, Iowa. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, guys. This is a fun show. I just had to call in and ask if Millie is related to, or whereabouts she grew up in what part of the state.
Garrison, Iowa. Where is Garrison, Mildred?
Garrison is about halfway between Waterloo and Cedar Rapids, just outside of Vinton, and it's about 2.5 miles off of 218.
Okay, because
and it's in Benton County.
Okay, my husband's mother-in-law was an Armstrong. Were you an Armstrong?
Yes. Where did they live?
They northeast Iowa, kind of pretty northeast Iowa.
Up in the West Branch area.
Lime Springs area. Cresco. But I tell you what, everything you've been saying, especially the sayings, she always had. Their whole family, that whole Armstrong side, were all a bunch of characters. I mean, characters. And he owned her dad, would have been like your dad's age probably, owned a trucking line and a livestock. He sold cattle in Chicago and was one of the biggest livestock traders in the area going into Chicago at that time. But she, I just loved her. And she was so just vibrant till the very end. I mean, she was a vibrant person and always had sayings, hotter than a pistol, called everybody picayunes, and all kinds of
Well, it sounds to me as if you ought to write your own book, at least a little one, on those sayings. I think those sayings are very are just absolutely great. You know, there is a regional what is it? Slang dictionary. It's a regional dictionary. I have 3 volumes of it. It's being published, I think, in Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
And I have 3 volumes of it, but I don't. I think that there are more by now.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably could go in there. Oh, because I think these things are just precious.
I do, too. Thanks so much for your call. Let's talk just a little bit before we go back to our flooded phone bank of medicine. When you were hurt, it makes me, when I read that chapter, I thought, we really are babies now. We run to the doctor all the time. But you had these amazing home remedies for things that ail the children and the elderly, and that people just didn't think of themselves as being really sick unless they were really sick.
As a matter of fact, it was considered just a teeny character defect if you got sick.
Huh.
And it was denied that you were sick. And like the include those little scenes where people, the oldest generation, like my grandpa's generation, they would not go to bed unless they were practically dying. They would put these 2 tall back chairs together and put a blanket on it, and then they would put these up by the stove, and they would sit there with the blanket, and they'd be sick as could be. But the other thing was, is that I'm amazed that we lived. I'm amazed we survived the cuts and bruises.
Right, yeah.
Like my mother, these stone bruises that we would get between our toes, they were deep infections, actually. Mm. And it's absolutely amazing. I had a friend call, incidentally, who called and said that they had used my book. They were visiting a friend of mine, and they had, she had shown them my book, and they had read the medicine chapter. And it, lo and behold, her husband, she looked at her husband's arm, and he had a red streak running up his arm. And she said they immediately went to the emergency room, and he did indeed have an infection. And it wasn't blood poisoning, it was a bacterial infection. But instead of taking me to a doctor, my mother just took a match, sterilized it by the edge of this sharp razor, and opened it up, and I had, I can't tell you, immediate relief. Immediate. It just miraculous.
Isn't that something? As soon as she cut that open.
Mm. And all of these things that we did, we just didn't pay much attention.
As I said,
we didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the germ theory of disease.
Right. And do you still use some of those home remedies, Mildred?
Oh, I use a lot of them, to
do
tell you?
You
the truth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the concoctions, too. Grape juice was always a big thing in our family. My grandfather had, my grandfather's grandfather had established a wonderful grapevines out in Yankee Grove, and everybody came to get cuts from them. And grape juice was considered a cure-all. We did, and the use of the membrane on the inside of an egg, that's still used. And, of course, the egg white on the face, it can't be beat.
You let it dry, right? Does it moisturize the skin or something?
It moisturizes it. It pulls out all the surface dirt. And it tightens up the skin. It feels wonderful.
Now, what would you do with the yolk, though? Because you wouldn't throw that out.
No. You would put that in, boil it, and put that in a salad.
Put it in a salad.
Oh, yes.
More phone calls for Mildred in a moment. We're talking with the author of Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. Mildred Armstrong Kalish, she is our guest. We have one line open. Take it. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Mildred Armstrong Kalish. Her wonderful book is Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. She's a retired professor of English, grew up in Garrison, Iowa. She has taught at the University of Iowa, Adelphi University, and Suffolk Community College, and now lives in Northern California, where she and her husband will soon celebrate their 64th wedding anniversary. Let's go to Bill next, Mildred from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mildred Kalish. Thank you very much for your book. I enjoyed it immensely.
I'm so happy to hear that.
And also, thank you for the apple cream pie recipe.
Oh,
it was delicious. Thank you.
I'm so happy to know that you made it and enjoyed it.
Oh, I did. I didn't make my own crust, but it came out delicious anyway.
Listen, I want you to try that oil crust. It cannot be ruined.
I will.
It's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that you like that pie. I've given it to about 1,000 people.
I'm sure you've heard this often as well. My grandparents are from your generation, and they grew up on the farm.
Great.
They moved to the city, and the one thing that they always gave me from the country was a gigantic garden. And also, some of my earliest memories are just sitting in the garden eating the vegetables.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. That is some of my best memories, too. It's an experience to eat vegetables and say strawberries and tomatoes especially.
Oh, tomatoes especially.
The room temperature, and when they're dead ripe, there's no flavor like it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so happy to hear you say that.
Oh, no, I loved your book. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
You.
Thank you for the call. We go next to Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
I am looking forward to buying your book, and I'm going to have to buy a copy for my father, who, during World War II, his mother worked in northern Illinois, and then his father was in the Navy, so he was sent to live in Iowa with his aunt and uncle. And he still has the .22 that his uncle gave him.
Isn't that great? Isn't that lovely? I love hearing about things like that.
Yeah. In World War II, tell me a little bit about World War II. When we were talking earlier about your family not showing emotion, I was amazed by what your grandfather said to your to your brother, I think, when he served, and you know, he came back and he couldn't give him a hug or a kiss, but what he said to him was was remarkable.
It was that was just great. Well, emotion, as I said in the book, we just didn't have a way to show affection to people. It just didn't exist, you know. And so instead, I think we sort of the outlet was for animals. You would hug and kiss a cat, a puppy, a lamb, even maybe even a horse.
And your mother taught you early on. I was struck by It was a bird, a canary or something that got loose. The way you treated this, sometimes you just had to let animals go.
Yes, I think that's one of the most important things that I learned. I think that in this life of growing up, having to put a pet away is one of the hardest things to do. You know, you love them and they become a part of your life so much. And I mean, in our family, we treat them like people.
Oh, sure. So do we.
And the only way that I could get around, and we've had to put down several animals, and just before we moved into the forum here, we had to put down a 19-year-old 20-pound cat who had been with us for all that time. And the only way you can do it is say, I've got to put him out of his misery. He had developed cancer. And the thing to do is to think that that animal is in pain, it cannot survive, and you just got to say, I'm doing it for the animal. And stop thinking about how much you're going to miss the animal. Then you go away and cry for years.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Kim from Oconomowoc. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I just called because I tuned in late, but I lived in Garrison in the late 60s on a parsonage out in the country, and I was just curious if she was familiar with, it was a Presbyterian parsonage, and I can't even remember now where it was.
Was it south of Garrison? South of Garrison? I can't imagine a parsonage unless it had been up in the Carlisle Grove area.
That I don't know. I was only 9 or 10 years old, and I went to the Garrison Elementary School, and it was a parsonage out. And the only other landmark I can give you is Barb and Warren Whitmer lived around the corner from us. And they were dairy farmers. And isn't that funny? I remember that play. It was a Presbyterian parsonage, had a little cemetery next to it and a great big old house. It was like the favorite house I ever lived in because all the rooms were, of course, I was very young, but all the rooms were just huge, and it was just a fabulous, fabulous experience when we grew up there. And so I was just curious if you were familiar with that.
I don't remember a house like that. And I just went back to Garrison in the September.
Oh, you did?
Yes, and I of course the Presbyterian Church in Garrison has been torn down even before I left, and a residence was built on it. And I don't remember any parsonage around Garrison. I just can't remember it.
Why did you go back in September, Mildred?
To do a book talk site.
Oh, really?
Book talks in Iowa City and to rest a retirement community and to Barnes & Noble in Cedar Rapids and then one in Benton and in Garrison. And I had an absolutely wonderful time. All the family were there. My second son and his family came up from Sarasota, Florida. And my daughter-in-law and son from here, my husband, and we had a ball. I had got to take them out to the Yankee Grove Cemetery and Yankee Grove and show them where our farmhouses used to be and tramp all over Garrison and show them where my Aunt Belle outshot those three young men. And we had an absolutely wonderful time.
Oh, I'm so glad. And the farms are not there anymore, Mildred?
The farm houses and buildings have been torn down. There is not a tree.
Oh.
And that's very sad. I had the great fun, though, of, and also by my youngest grandson, who's 10 years old, we went out to a farm who's a shirt-tail relation and got to drive a six-row corn combine.
Hmm.
And it is a wonderful thrill. It was just great. This one man can handle 1,200 acres, and it's sort of sad at the same time. But it was a thrill to go back and see what farming is like now.
Right. Thanks, Kim, so much for your call. Let's go to June from Eau Claire next. Hi, June.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about home remedies. I know when I grew up, if we were sick, my mother would fix, she called it bear soup.
Oh, great. Tell me about it.
Well, it's hot milk and a little butter, salt and pepper, and toast cut up. But, you know, bear soup, well, we ate it.
I think that is great. I know that.
Just hot milk, you know, I think the hot milk. And then my dad, once years ago, stopped into some neighbors we knew, and their little girl put her hand flat on the iron. You know,
her mother
just got done ironing, and she just stuck it on there.
Oh,
and then she was going to rush her to the doctor or something. And my dad said, no, peel a potato, grate a potato fine.
Oh, yeah.
Raw potato. He packed that hand with raw potato, wrapped it up. She said the little girl slept all night long, unwrapped it in the morning, couldn't tell a thing.
Isn't it? You have a potato story in your book, too, don't you, Mildred?
Oh, yes. And, you know, person is still alive. Melvin is still alive, and my potato story was the one how to take warts off.
Right, that's right. Yeah,
and that's that worked. Absolutely worked, and I love it. I love these remedies. I just love to hear about these remedies. I never heard of using potatoes, scraped potatoes.
No,
we used raw beets as a poultice.
Uh-huh.
And they work absolutely splendidly.
This was just raw potato. I don't know where my dad, I suppose, got it from his mother or folks. Who knows?
Of course he did.
Mm-hmm.
Of course he did. Well, good to hear about things like that.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Susan is next from Summit. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I just wanted to call in because my parents were actually, they were married in 1930 in Iowa, and they were both from family farms in around Sheldon, which is northwest. I don't know if you know that area.
Just a little.
Things that you're saying, I bought the book for myself and my older sister, who's 20 years older than I am, so there's a big span. But it's very interesting that even though there's this big age span with us, how much the things that you're talking about, the frugalness, the reusing, everything, from my oldest sister to myself, we still have it. I mean, and I grew up, my parents, my mother's father lost their farm in the Depression.
Yes.
And my father's farm stayed in the family, but my grandfather died, and my father and his brothers took care of it. And when my father got married to my mother, they moved in with the in-laws.
Yes.
So my mother took care of her mother-in-law and her two bachelor brothers-in-law, and they lived there with till they had four children.
Oh, great.
And my mother said she got up every morning and she milked the cows, and then she came in and she had to bake bread for the week or the day or whatever. I remember a story that they told that when at one point it was so bad they didn't have any money or anything, and my father had a gun, and he went and he sold his gun so they could buy groceries.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Hard times.
Yes, those times those times were real, and they were hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the important thing is to understand that it wasn't necessarily those failures were not the responsibility of a good number of those people. There just was no money around, and there were no jobs.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. We're out of time, Mildred. Thank you so much for joining us and for writing the book. It deserves all the wonderful attention it's received. And happy anniversary. Early.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
It was great fun.
Yeah, it was great fun. Mildred Armstrong Kalish, the book is Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. It's been published by Bantam and is available in bookstores and in libraries. She's a retired professor of English, grew up in Garrison, Iowa, and she's taught at the University of Iowa, Adelphi University, and Suffolk Community College, now living in Northern California. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thank you, everybody, for all of your wonderful calls. They were good. It was a good hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll be with you again tomorrow, same time, 9 to 11. So please join us. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.